Well, the next trial of our friend Lancelot was what is known as the Sword Bridge. This is a bridge across a roaring torrent that is of a sword. And he has to go across with bare hands and feet on the sharp edge of a sword. Perhaps you know the novel by Somerset Maugham, The Razor's Edge. This is a motif from, I think it's the Kena Upanishad. Any trip along your own path is a razor's edge. It really is. Nobody's done it before. And it's so easy, particularly if what you're following is your bliss, is your passion. It's so easy to tip over and fall into a torrent of passion that sweeps you away. This is a real lesson. So, having survived the perilous bed, Lancelot survives the sword bridge. And then he has disenchanted the castle in which Guinevere is a captive. He comes in to receive her great greeting and gratitude, and she's as cold as ice. Why? Because he hesitated for three steps before getting on that cart. How did she know? She's the goddess. Women know these things. And this is that story, and it's the great one. This is Chretien's best. It's a beautiful story. The Lancelot. His next story is one that appears also in a Welsh version known as The Lady of the Fountain. This is called the Yvain, Y-V-A-I-N. I won't go through the whole story except to give a bare outline. A knight comes to Arthur's court and tells of an adventure in which he had failed. It was of a castle and a tree, and under the tree was a spring. And beside the spring was a stone. And hanging from the tree was a ladle. And the adventure consisted in dipping water from the spring onto the stone, at which moment a terrific storm arose. And all the leaves and birds were blown from the tree. Out of the castle came storming the black knight, the thunder knight, and engaged the one who had dipped the water in combat. This knight had been overthrown. Well, the knight Yvain, on hearing this story, says, I'm going to attempt the adventure. And he does. And when the knight comes out, Yvain kills the knight. His lance goes through the knight's body. The knight turns and is on riding his horse still, he dying, runs into the castle. And Yvain, following, gets caught in the portcullis. As say, these castles had trap gates which would drop, and he got caught between the two trap gates with his horse. A beautiful young girl in the castle, who was the queen's servant maid, sees him thus caught, thinks, this is a beautiful knight. He should become the husband of my lady who has just lost her husband. This is the phrase, a golden bough, where the one that kills the priest becomes the priest of the queen. It's a hangover of an old, old mythological theme. Yvain does become her spouse. He forgets Arthur's court. Now you know what this is. You have found your bliss, but it has disengaged you from your world of duties. And he's there with her. Arthur's knights come and pour water on the stone. He has to come out then as the Thunder Knight, and he engages with Bedivere, I think it is. Neither can defeat the other. They don't know who he is. Then they unhelm themselves and they say, oh, hi, Yvain, come on to the court. And he goes then with the Arthur's knights to the court and forgets the ladies. This is a basic spiritual problem. The split between the two worlds. And the lady then sends a messenger and tells him, "You have lost me." And he then tries the adventure of getting back to her. And the whole thing is of that ordeal of recovering the relationship to your true being and then bringing her to the court. That's the whole problem of life. It's right there in that story. Do you get me? That's the problem. Tristan, Eric, Cleges, Lancelot, Yvain, and then Chrétien writes The Percival, which is the Grail, Chrétien's Grail story. So before I come to The Percival, I'm going to get going now on Tristan and bring out the main points there. There are about six or eight Tristans of the Middle Ages. The one that is most important is that of Gottfried of Strasbourg, who died before he finished his Tristan, and you have to continue with the story on which he was modeling his own. The characteristic of medieval storytelling is you don't invent the story, you develop it. You take a traditional story and interpret it, give it new depth and meaning in terms of the conditions of your particular day. The story of Tristan is of a youth, and this is a typical epic hero, a youth whose parents have died. The son of the widow or the orphan son. His mother's brother is the king of Cornwall, and he is born in Brittany. So here we have this Brittany and Cornwall, the whole Celtic world. Tristan goes to his uncle's castle in Cornwall and arrives just at the time that an emissary has come from the court of Ireland, of Dublin. The Irish king has conquered the Cornish king and is requiring every 4 or 5 years or something the giving of young boys and girls to the service of the Irish throne. This is based on the story of Crete, you know, and Theseus and the Minotaur. Tristan arrives just as Morholt arrives from Ireland to collect youths and maidens to bring to the Irish court. Now, the queen of the Irish court is Isolde's mother, whose name is Isolde. And Isolde's mother has prepared a poison, which is on the sword of Morholt, who has come to collect the boys and girls. Tristan says to his father, to his uncle, "Let me handle that guy." His father, his uncle says, "This is very dangerous." He says, "No, this is the only way." So a jousting, champion's battle is prepared between Morholt and Tristan. Tristan rides against Morholt. Morholt's sword comes down on his knee, cuts him. The poison is injected. He's as good as dead. He replies by bringing his sword down on Morholt's head and splits the helmet and enters the skull, and a chink from Tristan's sword remains in the skull. Morholt is brought back dead to Ireland, and his niece, Isolde, who loved her uncle, when the piece of the sword is pulled out of his head, takes that and puts it in her little treasure chest to remember Uncle Morholt. Tristan becomes terribly sick. The wound is festering, gangrene sets in, and he says to his uncle, "Just put me in a little boat with my harp, and this boat will carry me to the source of this poison." And indeed, by magic, the boat carries him to Dublin Bay. And people hear this beautiful music. He was a miraculous young man. And they bring him to the Queen Isolt to be cured. She doesn't recognize this, you know. You don't tell everything in a story, otherwise you don't have a story. You know, she seems not to have recognized that it was her poison that was killing him, and who this chap was. He called himself, he disguised himself. His name is Tristan, but he called himself Tan Trist, so no one knew who he was. And she is curing him. And when the wound has been healed to such an extent that the stench of his presence can be tolerated, she invites her daughter, Isolde, in to hear him play the harp. He plays so wonderfully. And immediately the two fall in love, only don't know it. I'm sure somebody here has had this experience. And this is the whole understanding of the story by Gottfried. They are crazy in love with each other, just don't know it. He played the harp better than he'd ever played it in his life. And the model for this, Tristan becomes her teacher of the harp. The model for this was the story of Abelard and Heloise one century before, 1116, where Abelard was Heloise's teacher and seduced her. Tristan is the teacher of Isolde. Now this silly boy, when he's cured, he goes back to Cornwall and he says, "Oh, Uncle Mark, I met the most wonderful girl. She'd be just the wife for you." So he speaks so gloriously of this wonderful girl that his uncle and the barons say, "Well, why don't you go over and fetch her for me?" So Tristan, now calling himself Tantrist again, goes back to fetch Isolde to his uncle Mark. Now you see the courtly love problem here? Tristan has fallen in love. His uncle has never seen Isolde. Mark and Isolde marriage is standard medieval violence. There's no love in it. So from the point of view of the courtly love, Mark is disqualified. He's simply what is technically called le jaloux, the jealous one, that's the husband. So Tristan goes back to fetch Isolde. Well, what has happened has been that a great dragon has begun to trouble the country, and the king has said, the person who kills that dragon can have Isolde as his wife. That's good old standard medieval stuff again. The dragon's a little bit unusual, but not in stories. So there is a young seneschal, or a courtier in the court, who wants Isolde, but he doesn't have the guts to kill a dragon. But he keeps hanging around when he thinks anyone's going to kill a dragon. He wants to be around. Perhaps he can make the claim. Tristan rides at the dragon. Gottfried was a cleric. He was a low-degree priest. And no noble, no warrior. And he describes this thing in the most amusing, comical way of the killing of this dragon. The dragon bites off the first half of the horse and all that kind of thing, but the lance kills the dragon expires, and Tristan, to state his claim, cuts out the dragon's tongue and puts it in his shirt. That's the worst thing you can do with the dragon's tongue, because it's poisonous. So he's walking along with the dragon's tongue against his shirt, and it overtakes him, and he falls into a pool, and all that's sticking up is his nose. There he is under the water. The other chap, meanwhile, cuts off the dragon's head and presents it as his claim for Isolde. Well, Isolde and their mother are out walking, and they come past this pool, and they look down. Why, look at that. There's this nose, and then under that, a man. So they take him out, and Queen Isolde's used to curing people, so they take him home to cure him. And his sword, the whole equipment, is with him. Well, Isolde, one fine day, when Tristan happens to be recovering pretty well, he's in the bathtub now. She's fooling around with his sword and sheath and so forth. She pulls the sword out of the sheath, and wow, there's a nick in the sword. And she runs to her little treasure chest, and there is the thing that came out of Uncle Morhen's head. It fits. So with the sword in her hand, she goes in and hits Tristan in the bathtub. And she's got this thing up, and he says, "Hold on. You kill me and that other guy gets you." Well, the sword was getting kind of heavy anyhow, so she let that one go. And when he's cured finally, comes this wonderful affair of the giving of Isolde to the killer of the dragon. And this lout comes in with the dragon's head. And Tristan just says, "Let's open the mouth and see what's inside. There's no tongue." "Where's the tongue?" "Why, right here." So Tristan gets the girl. So now, instead of taking her to himself, he's going to take her back to King Mark. So you can see what a silly he is. He's only 15 years old, so he doesn't know what's happened to him, actually. And her mother prepares this love potion. Now, there's a secret here. The poison and the love potion are essentially the same potion. The pain of love, the sickness unto death that no doctors can cure, all that sort of thing. So the same woman who brought him there by poisoning him is now preparing the love potion. It's going to be the fulfillment of this whole affair. But it's to be between Isolde and Mark. On the way, here's Brangaine, the nurse, little Isolde's nurse, who is to go with them and keep the love potion and present it at the time of the marriage. But on the boat, as I've said, they drink the potion. Now comes a problem, a theological problem. If the love potion compels you to love, then the love of Tristan and Isolde, although it is adulterous, is not a mortal sin. To commit a mortal sin, you must have a serious matter, sufficient reflection, and full consent of the will. But if it's magic that's done it, there's no consent of the will, and this is perfectly innocent love. Let's think about that. And so a number of the authors of the Tristan story fixed it up so that the love potion would work for 2 or 3 years. And then when it stops, sin begins, you know. When does sin begin? This is aside, this reminds me of a story. A priest and a minister and a Jewish rabbi are discussing the problem of when does life begin? This has to do with the abortion problem. And the priest says, "It begins at conception." And the minister said, "Life begins after 2 weeks or 2 months or something of this kind." And the Jewish rabbi says, "Life begins when the children have graduated." well, anyhow, when does sin begin? So the couple drink the potion. And here's the situation that I spoke of earlier. You have drunk your death. There's a great heroic statement in the Middle Ages. I accept hell fire for this. And it won't be hell if I still am burning with the love for Isolde. That's what it's saying. So comes the wedding. The nastiest bit in the whole thing is that Isolde persuades Brangaine to take her place in bed for the first marriage night. She can't bear that idea. Brangaine plays the role, and King Mark thinks it's Isolde. I mean, he's doubly disqualified. This is inattention to details, which just eliminates it. So the two are having their affair, and King Mark presently becomes aware of it. Now, properly, they should be killed. He can't bear it. He loves them both. This is a noble man. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful handling of the problem. So he just says, "Get out of my sight. Go away." And they go into the forest. These are the forest years of Tristan and Isolde. They come to a cave, a carved cave, fashioned by the giants of pre-Christian times, back to the old Celtic Germanic times. And over the door entrance, it says in inscription, the chapel for lovers. And they go in there, and the whole chapel is symbolic. Every detail of it has a symbolic meaning. Chastity, loyalty, purity, and all this kind of thing. All the terms have new meanings, of course, in this context. And where the altar would have been is a bed of crystal. And the sacrament of the altar is the sacrament of sex. Gottfried Strasbourg meant this, and the medieval people meant this. The sacrament of love is sexual intercourse. And it is a sacrament. And it is. Well, they're there, and it's beautiful. Just above the bed are two openings in the roof through which light comes. One fine day, they hear off in the woods the blowing of hunting horns. These are the hunting horns of King Mark. He's out on a hunt. And Tristan thinks, if Mark comes and looks down through these and sees us asleep together, this will be too bad. So what does he do? He places his sword between himself and Isolde. Do you catch the sense of this? Honor against love? This is the sin of Tristan, to have put the sword between. And when Mark looks down, indeed, he sees the two with the sword between, and he says, oh, I have misunderstood them. So he invites them back to court. And that, of course, is the end of their affair, because they continue the affair, they are caught again, and this time there's no fooling. Tristan is exiled, he goes to Brittany, but before he goes to Brittany, Isolde has to undergo an ordeal. Now, this may have been an actual ordeal in the Middle Ages. She is to take an oath that she has not lain with any man but her husband. And having taken that oath, she is to take in her hand a red-hot iron bar. And if the hand is not burned, she is validated and released from the accusation. So she's on the way to this trial, and they've arranged that she has to cross a river in a boat. So Tristan, in disguise, takes the job of being the boatman. So he's the ferryman, ferries her across, and then has to lift her out of the boat and manages to trip and fall on top of her. And then she goes to the trial. She says, I've lain with no man but my husband and the boatman that fell on top of me. So she didn't tell a lie, and the thing didn't burn. Well, Gottfried says, and so you see, Christ is like a weather vane. He blows where the wind goes. That may be why Gottfried didn't finish the book. No one knows how he died, but they were burning people to death in those days for statements of that kind. Anyhow, Tristan goes to Brittany. And now comes the last part of the story. In Brittany, he hears of a young lady whose name is Isolde. She's known as Isolde of the White Hands. And this is the kind of thing that happens in medieval romance. He falls in love with the name, and so marries the lady, poor little Isolde of the White Hands. But because she isn't the Isolde, he can't have intercourse with her. He can't bring himself to that act. So she's out riding with her brother one day, and the horse steps into a puddle and splashes, and the water splashes up high on her thigh, and she says to her brother, horse is bolder than Tristan. And her brother says, what? And he learns about this, and goes to Tristan and complains, and Tristan tells him of his love for the other Isolde, and he understands the whole thing. Then Tristan gets into a battle and is wounded unto death. The only person who could cure him would be Isolde. He sends his little wife's brother to bring Isolde to him, and you know the rest of the story. they have a arrangement. If Isolde has consented to come, the boat will have a white sail. If she has refused, it has a black sail. He is dying in his wife's arms. The boat is coming, and she tells him the sail is black. Actually, it was white, and he dies. The Tristan story. The echoes are of Theseus and the Minotaur all along the line. So this is the situation. Love against marriage, and you might call it counterculture against the culture. How do we bring these things together? The marriage situation was that of normal medieval and oriental custom, of the family arranging the marriage. The aristocracy of Europe regarded this as intolerable, and you have the whole theme of love. Now, I think you probably would enjoy just breaking for about 15 minutes, and I want to give you the grail answer to this, which is, in my thinking, one of the great, great stories of the Middle Ages. I think Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal is the high story of the Middle Ages. I would put it above Dante's Divine Comedy. Dante ends up in heaven. Gottfried ends up on earth. And the thing is solved here, now, in the flesh, and in a magnificent way.